I first approached Reverend Chris about doing this service where what I will do is talk a little bit about who we are, which is the history of the fellowship. And I recognize that this is a little bit presumptuous of me, although I will also say that I realized that I have now been a member of the fellowship for about half of its total lifetime. There are people in the room who have been members since the very beginning, but I do have some perspective on reflecting on who we are as a fellowship. And then I asked Reverend Chris if he would be willing to talk about the history of the denomination, Unitarian and Universalist, in that same sort of time frame. And then I'll close with a few reflections on where we are now and where we might be going. So who are we? Now is balanced on the knife edge between the past and the present. Who we are is understood by understanding who we have been and looking ahead to who we might be. Let us first begin by looking back. Who have we been? And we should acknowledge that when we refer to the Keweenaw Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in the singular, we're using a shorthand. So how many KUUFs have there been? And how many are there now? There's no simple answer to those questions. The fellowship, when it was founded, is not the fellowship as it is now. And that statement is so obvious that it borders on vacuity. Of course, there have been changes. That much is obvious. The majority of the members of the fellowship have become members since I became a member in 2003. So I was reflecting on that and realized that maybe it is a little presumptuous for me to talk about the history of the fellowship, but I also realized that I'm one of the old timers now, so to speak. There's also continuity. There are members here today who have been members from the beginning, and we're going to play a little Q&A at the end of this. So why was the fellowship founded? Who were we then? As I understand from talking to many of the founding members, they wanted liberal religious education for their children, as well as just a general liberal religious home in the Keweenaw. The fellowship at that time was predominantly humanist. They met two Sundays per month, and we'll talk a little bit about where they met at the end of this part of the service. And for a while, student ministers from Meadville, Lombard, and Chicago came up once per month to conduct services. That fellowship made it a priority to have a minister. They were also talking at that time about a building of our own, and that conversation has ebbed and flowed with the passage of time, coming to the forefront and fading to the background, depending on who got interested in it at the time, but we can talk about that a little bit later. As you might imagine, the expenses at that time were modest. I will say modest, but not zero. Those members set aside money every year over and above what was needed, and they're one of the reasons that we have the solid financial position that we do today. In the early 2000s, we learned that a UU minister was living in Minocqua and might be interested in serving our fellowship in a part-time role. And that was the beginning of Reverend Sidney Morris's service with our fellowship. She was our first settled minister. When she went from one-third time to full-time, the fellowship's budget increased by 25%. That's a big jump in a single year, and it is daunting, and I remember being daunted because I was the treasurer at the time. So I was the one looking at that 25% and thinking to myself, I don't know if we can do this. But we did it. We surmounted that challenge. When Reverend Morris left for a congregation in Oregon, we were without a minister for 6 months. Reverend Gabby arrived after having been delayed just outside of Munising. That was one of the coldest winters. Actually, that one was the coldest winter since I've been here. It was about minus 10 that day. It was beautiful, though. It was sunny. And there were, I think, close to a dozen of us who showed up to help her bring boxes from the truck into the house. Most of that year, the search committee spent following the UUA's protocols and putting our search packet together. And then Reverend Rothbauer started in August of 2015. And I've skimmed over a lot of the recent history since most of you know it fairly well because you were here yourselves. And I've deliberately left our relationship to the denomination and all of this out of it, and Reverend Rothbauer will follow this discussion with that. But I thought to engage all of us in a little bit of who we are and thinking about who we might be, we would play a little Q&A. Who's the first signature in the book?
Jim Boyce.
Jim Boyce is the first signature in the book. September 29th, 1985. As I was looking at this yesterday, and I was reading the first few names in the book, and these are people who I know, with a couple of exceptions, and it struck me that the sixth signature in the book is Karen Kraft. Now, some of you know Karen, and at the time, Karen, she had to have been maybe a teenager. Is that right?
Yes.
So even then, we had people who were, I'm guessing Jim was probably my age at that time. Ken and Susie probably were. And then we were welcoming in people of all walks. Okay, who are the two newest signatures in the book? Laura knows.
The two what?
Anybody else? It's Jerry Coffey and Bob Lane, both of whom signed the book on September 10th of this year. Where have we met? Where has KUUF met? Well, okay, so the first one is obvious, it's here.
People's homes.
Upstairs in the other building.
So upstairs in the other building, and I think there's one more, isn't there?
There is at the Heights, the daycare center.
The daycare center in Daniel Heights was also one of the meeting houses in the early days. Okay, so this one is one of them I think most everybody will get, and one of them I'm not sure anybody will get. There have been two pair of presidents who shared the same last name. Who are they? In other words, there are four people, two of whom have the same last name, and then another two have the same last name. So I heard someone say Bill and Barry. That's correct. That's one of them. Anybody know the other one?
Voices?
Bakers? Have you and Al both been?
No, because there was another baker besides Al.
Not president.
No. Oh, president.
Bill and Barry.
So Bill and Barry are one. I'm not sure Alice was ever president. Alice was treasurer forever, but I don't think she was ever president.
Or in Ticketing?
No. I'll give you a hint. The last name is Johnson. John Johnson is one.
Keith Johnson
was the other. Okay. When did KUUF become a welcoming congregation?
A wealthy congregation?
No. Welcoming.
Welcoming.
For those of you who didn't catch that, Al just asked me, he's like, when did KUUF become a wealthy congregation?
I hope they were always wealthy.
Bill Gates was a member in the early 90s. Didn't you know that?
It was early in the 2000s.
It was early in the 2000s. And actually, this is when I'm asking the question. I don't actually know the exact date, but I know it was early in the 2000s because I remember the workshops and the vote leading up to... we had to vote as a congregation to become a welcoming congregation, and when we did, they sent us the poster that we now proudly display in the entryway, which committees are explicitly mentioned in KUUF's bylaws.
Well,
There are three.
Finance.
Finance is one.
Membership.
Membership is not one.
Worship?
Worship is not one.
Social justice?
Social justice is not one.
Ministerial?
The Committee on Ministry is explicitly mentioned in the bylaws, and there's one more.
The Nominating Committee.
The Nominating Committee is also explicitly mentioned in the bylaws. And by the way, this exercise that we just went through and naming all of those committees that you named that are not in the bylaws, I actually find that encouraging. We don't have to have those committees, and yet we have those committees. That shows that those things are important to us. And this question I'm not going to wait for an answer to, but I think it's an important question to consider and to hold and to think about. And that is, what has the fellowship done? And with that, I'll turn it over to Reverend Chris.
Occasionally, I hear someone who, when they hear about our movement's very imperfect history, express surprise that we have just as many things to be sorry for as anyone else. It's easy to believe that a liberal, progressive, and inclusive denomination is somehow better than everyone else, and that we are utopia here on Earth. We like to focus on the fact that we were one of the first denominations to be inclusive of LGBT folks, on our cutting-edge efforts for racial justice and environmental justice, on our struggles to understand our place in economic justice. And I usually respond, and I actually found myself responding this week, that our movement is full of human beings, with all the flaws that come with them. People are products of their time and culture, and there's no escaping that history will have negative things to say even about us. So to take an example that's a bit before our time, take the Iowa Sisterhood. These were women, mostly Unitarians and a few Universalists, who felt the call to ministry and sought to fulfill their calling by entering seminary and becoming ordained. We love to brag. We love to brag that Olympia Brown, the first woman to be ordained as a minister in a mainline American denomination, was from us. But at that time, the reality was that female ministers were almost completely unheard of, and most of the Iowa Sisterhood were denied the opportunity to become ministers because denominational officials couldn't see past the norms of their times. Even the few who did gain ordination, such as Brown, were all too often subsequently rejected by the churches they served, which were not ready to move beyond the comfort of what they considered normal. They were imperfect products of the environment they existed in and made mistakes just as any of us would have in their shoes. The point isn't to dwell on these imperfections, but rather to ask, what can we learn from them? When I study mistakes of the past, I want to avoid making those mistakes going forward. In the case of the Sisterhood, it's clear that many very capable ministers were prevented from fully realizing their potential, and many of them planted churches, mostly in Iowa and the Dakotas, some of which still exist today. I know some of you find your way to Sioux Falls on occasion. That's one of them. Their contributions to these communities is unsurpassed, and there's little doubt today that the parish is where they belonged. Indeed, we still find these examples all throughout our movement. In August, I talked about how our faith was slow to understand Black power. It's a sad indictment, too, that eugenics with all its racist, sexist, and classist assumptions, was advanced by Unitarianism, perhaps epitomized by Supreme Court Justice and Unitarian Oliver Wendell Holmes' quote, that three generations of imbeciles is enough. And there's been plenty since then. We've had a very imperfect record. We've had a very imperfect record on race, on class, on economic justice. I was reminded just this week in a phone call with our president, Susan Frederick Gray, that the first trans minister was ordained in the 1980s, but there were no trans ministers settled in a denomination in our denomination until 2002. And it wasn't for lack of trying. We found our voice in environmental justice and did a lot of good there, and at the same time stumbled when it came to finding women and people of color pulpits. We had financial crises, which made us question whether we would be able to survive, including the current one, where $500,000 has been earmarked from the UUA's budget for two people who resigned. And I'm sure we will continue to foible and make mistakes, as the current debate on ableist language in our movement symbolizes. Now, the point isn't to demonize us. Plenty of other faiths and organizations share as much culpability as we do. The point is that for all our advancements, every organization, Unitarian Universalists included, find it difficult, even when they profess a position, to fully embrace it, at least at first. We stumble and stumble and hurt a lot of people in the process, and if we're lucky, we come out at the end better than we were before, but never quite finished with the work. That's the thing about utopia. It's never quite here. Always on the horizon, just a few inches away from materializing. Our movement, like all other movements throughout history, is a microcosm of brilliant imperfection, constantly striving to redefine ourselves in order to bring in those whom we've previously left behind. We can look at it as exhausting work, given that it means our movement is always striving to be better than it previously was. Or we can look at it as holy work, work that brings us closer to the idea of beloved community, one where all are included, where every person has their own place at the table of love and acceptance. Though the events of the national movement may seem distant to many of us, let us not forget that the movement's successes and foibles are also our successes and foibles. We do not exist in a vacuum, and it behooves us to pay attention to both the good parts and the bad of our local and national history. It may be hard, even painful, to do so, but there is no growth as long as we believe, even so slightly, the myth that there is nothing on our faces. We may not know how history will judge us 30 years from now, but we can act the best we can to be people who are always re-examining our past and facing our present in order to shape the future.
Who will we be? I'll pose some questions, and here I truly cannot presume to answer them. I'm only a single voice in the chorus of what we are and will become. We, the people in this room and others who are not here for whatever reason, are KUUF now. It is we who will decide what KUUF will become. Are we a church? Some of us have been scarred by organized religion in the past for a panoply of reasons. Are we defined by those past experiences, or shall we reclaim that space? And I was thinking about this last night, and I intentionally put this paragraph in there because I remember there have been conversations in this very room about whether we're a church. This sacred space, and whether it's sacred is even a question to hold. What will we do with it? Is it a place of comfort? Is it a space for growth? Will we leave here feeling satisfied or with a sense of unease? And where might that unease come from? What do you remember from this time? I remember times of sorrow and of joy. I remember births and deaths. I recall celebrations. I recall homilies, sermons, whatever we want to call them, that I disagreed with, but that prompted me to think. Reverend Morris and Michael Servetus, a visiting minister whose name I just can't recall, it was during Reverend Morris's sabbatical. He gave a homily on the doctrine of just war. Reverend Gabby in the story of Mary on Easter Sunday. Reverend Chris's use of the Walking Dead in their first sermon during candidating week. James Luther Adams said, "Church is where we practice being human." What kind of humans will we be?